I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Freedom, a simple word, two syllables, seven letters, that embody one of the deepest longings of the human heart. It's a word and a concept we've been hearing a great deal lately, as the war winds down and policymakers begin envisioning what might come next in Iraq. It's also the central theme of Passover, which is being celebrated around the world this week, as Jews recall their freedom from slavery thousands of years ago. And of Easter celebrations this weekend, as Christians reflect on the death and resurrection of Jesus, a story that promises freedom from the fear of death. For Shia Muslims, the 40-day period that ends next week is marked in memory of the fate of Hussein, the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, centuries ago. Freedom and remembrance, these are the two great themes of the rituals that mark our time on planet Earth, beyond the turning of the seasons. Connection listeners, does ritual provide a foundation for the rest of your life? What would be missed without these pauses for remembrance and reflection? And how does reliving and retelling religious stories change or deepen your understanding of freedom? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me this hour is the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr. He is senior minister of the Riverside Church, an interdenominational church in New York City. Welcome, Dr. Forbes.
Good morning, Gail.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. I want to ask, first of all, whether you see freedom as the dominant theme here of both Passover and Easter.
Yes, freedom from so many things. Freedom from slavery in regards to Passover, freedom from the fear of death in regards to Easter, and freedom from a sense of rootlessness in regards to Shiite Muslims. And so freedom is, I think, the good connection for this holy season.
Do you also find that these celebrations perhaps offer a way to, in some way, reset our emotional clocks as a new season begins?
Yes, I believe that these holy days provide for us an opportunity to access the dimension of depth, which is always present under life, but we are not always aware of it, or we may not always access the power that it brings. So when we stop, take time for a Sabbath, cooling off from the rigors of our regular time, when we take special seasons to remember what the tradition says is the basis of our hope throughout the ordinary times, we get a kind of refresher. We get a broadening of our perspective and a new renewal of strength to keep on with the day-to-day responsibilities of life.
You just said a very important word, and that is stop, because I think most of us live our lives at such a pace that if you didn't have those markers, you wouldn't stop to reflect on these things at all.
That's exactly right. For an example, the pace of life in New York City is such that if we didn't have all the holidays we have, I wonder how we would make it. And also, in regards to religion in general, there are times when religion spends a lot of energy around how we ought to live our lives. But there needs to be a time when we look at why we propose certain approaches to life and where we find the strength to sustain the practices we are encouraged to live by.
Might be useful here to get down to some of the specifics of the holidays and the celebrations that we're talking about. Give us a little primer, if you will, on the details of the Passover story.
Well, the Passover story, as I recall, has to do with the fact that Israel was in bondage in Egypt. Then, years they prayed for deliverance. Then a leader, Moses, was sent, who was given the responsibility to go to Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." As a result of his ministry, there was a confrontation, and by many, many plagues and the demonstration of God's might, the text speaks of with God's outstretched arms, the Israel was released from bondage. And the night that was the climactic point was when the hosts of Pharaoh discovered that the power of God had decreed that an angel of death would pass over, and that the firstborn in the house of Pharaoh would be destroyed, and this became the definitive sign to Pharaoh that he had to let the people go. However, the people who had the on their doorposts the blood of the lamb, the ritual animals of that time, that the death angel would pass over that house, for it was in some way covered by a covenant connection. And so Passover, the angel of death passes over those who have made a commitment to the God of Israel in that time. And so from that time, they remember the meal they had. They remember the pace of preparation, getting ready to leave the bondage behind, to go forth through the wilderness toward the promised land.
So freedom came, but as you say, it was not easy, and it was not immediate either.
It was not immediate, it was not easy, and was not without its complications. Even after that night of Passover, there was to be a period of meandering in the wilderness on the way to the promised land. So the things that are promised on these high holy days will not really fit the spirit of quick fixes. There is enough of an indication of divine liberation that one is given the strength to live through the struggle necessary to reach the promised land of whatever kind of fulfillment one is looking for.
As you know, Dr. Forbes, on the table at every Seder, there is a special plate of items that reflect some of those key aspects of the story you were just telling us. There are bitter herbs, there's salt water, there's unleavened bread, there's haroset, and a roasted egg. Is it important to have this kind of specificity in terms of the symbols of the key elements of the holiday?
Yes, because whatever the holiday says in regards to the transcendent power of God, it has to touch the earth where we live, and it has to in some way engage our senses. So you see an empty chair, and you taste the bitter herbs, and you experience the transition from the dry mouth conditions to the water that's there. You have to be able to awaken your senses in order to internalize the deep spiritual meaning that is associated with our faith.
Are you concerned at all that the larger meaning of these celebrations can get somewhat diluted over time? I mean, there are jokes in each tradition about the people who only show up for Passover and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the holiest days of Judaism. There are the Easter Sunday Christians who just aren't there the rest of the year.
Let me tell you, I used to complain, but now I rejoice. If there is no other benefit to having these high holy days and the crowd that only comes then, it is their acknowledgement that whatever is at the heart of the story that centers the rituals, that there is some meaning there. And although they may not be regular practitioners, even they acknowledge that we need hope. We need to hear the story. We may not believe everything that's said about it, but the impulse is essential to the quality of life we need to live. So I always encourage people, look, don't be embarrassed. And I say to preachers, don't fuss at these people. They've honored your tradition by coming on the day that you say holds the central truths of the faith. So listen, anybody who wants to come on Easter, come on. Go out to Passover services. Go to the Seder, whatever. Let's acknowledge that, okay, even if you only do it once a year, at least you acknowledge that life cannot be lived without some engagement of the great story of divine liberation in the midst of the struggles of life.
Help us make the connection now between Passover and Easter, because Jesus was Jewish, so he would have been most likely celebrating a Seder that night in what Christians refer to as the Last Supper.
Yes, the Passover Supper was the moment seized by Jesus to, in a sense, make very clear the distinction between his tradition as practiced by many of his fellow Jews and what he, as a Jew, had seen as the way in which God's presence could be most closely identified in life. So it was, he took his tradition and by his own action at the Passover service brings about the nuance that leads to the development of the Christian understanding. So he takes the regular meal, but then he takes bread and says, this bread which came off the table from the Passover celebration that he had been engaged with his disciples, this bread is my body. I'm going to be offered up. Then he takes the cup. This cup is the blood of a sacrifice that I am going to make. For the integrity of my vision of love and spirit, I am going to give my life. And this will be the way that you will identify yourselves with me, for you will regularly meet to experience Holy Communion, this Last Supper. And I will hope that you will continue to do this until in that age beyond time, when we meet at the Messianic banquet, that you will keep on doing this in remembrance of what I have done in giving my life for you. That is the moment in which the distinction between the rituals of the Judaistic background from which Jesus came and the beginning of the particularity of the Christian experience. And of course, since Passover was the point at which he begins towards his passion in regards to the trial that follows, the crucifixion which takes place on what we now call Good Friday, the Silent Saturday, and then Easter. So it's all bunched together as a singular event that defines the ultimate sacrifice that brings salvation to those who consider themselves to be Christians.
And as you say, a particularly key element, I would think, is that theme of remembrance, because that's the carryover from Passover to the Last Supper of do this in remembrance of me. I mean, Jewish people had been told that from the days of the Exodus.
If the people of faith are to be sustained in their religion, they have to be a remembering people. Remembering for two reasons. One is that the accumulated experiences in history that give rise to foundational religious principles are not immediately discerned on anybody's particular workday. If you can't see it from the long, long line of history, you may miss it altogether. So remembering gives us the accumulated wisdom and the accumulated recital of God's mighty acts so as to allow us to tap into the long story and thereby identify the little resurrections we have seen or the little Passovers we have seen. And in that way, history and community will receive the particularity of our individual experiences. And in that way, the faith goes on and is energized for yet another year.
Connection listeners, we're talking this hour with the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr. about freedom as it is reflected in the celebrations of Passover and Easter, and also how ritual helps us define ourselves as human beings concerned with more than just survival. What place does remembrance and ritual serve in your life? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about holy time, as opposed to ordinary time in which we spend most of our days. And we're also talking about freedom this hour and how those two might be connected. My guest is the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr. of the Riverside Church in New York. Connection listeners, do you feel a particular need for holy time this year? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Dr. Forbes, this is Good Friday, and it would be interesting to hear from you your perspective on that day, because if you think about it, the events of that day could hardly be described as good.
That's exactly right. One always has to explain how on earth could the day in which your Savior or your leader was killed by execution, a day in which even according to the story, the very elements of the earth seem to be in mourning as well, you lose the one who has lifted up the principles of love and peace and justice and compassion, and then that voice is stilled, hushed in death. How do you call that? A Good Friday. Well, I think it helps to remember something that a theologian, Paul, who was in the early church, said, and that is that all things work together for good to those who love the Lord. And one of my professors, John Bennett, used to say, God doesn't will everything, but God wills something out of everything. And therefore, Good Friday, with all of the awful events, humankind's inhumanity to humankind at the highest scale, God uses the faithfulness of Jesus, who offers his life to show us that integrity is possible, that love is stronger than death, that if you stand by what you believe, even if your physical life is snuffed out, the power of God who started creation will activate your life and send you forth into a dimension beyond the biological existence. So, Good Friday could only be called Good Friday after Easter Sunday, where he is raised from the dead in a new form, not clear to everybody, and even the accounts show variations on what that means to people. But the man who was dead was raised again. Therefore, retrospectively, what was an awful, awful Friday, because of the salvation that is brought, because of the vindication of love and justice that seems to be achieved, retrospectively you say, it's a Good Friday. Awful in its original appearance, good in the light of Easter joy.
As I'm listening to you, I'm also thinking there's a connection here to the Passover story of, again, you know, be patient. You haven't heard the end of the story quite yet.
That's exactly right. I think patience is one of the lessons that comes out of these holy days, because people who go through struggle are crying out, "Oh Lord, how long have you forgotten me?" And even Jesus uses the words of the 22nd Psalm, my God, why hast thou forgotten me? If the holy days don't do anything else, they can remind people, hold on, weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And if it's Friday and nothing happens, and then there's a Saturday and nothing happens, hey, hold on, Easter's coming.
I know you're going to want to hear from some of our callers, Dr. Forbes. Let's go first to our phone line, Savannah, Georgia. Richard's phoning in. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call this morning. I would like to ask your guest about ritual. And, you know, we regardless of which religion you may choose to practice, we engage in the rituals from season to season, year to year. And they seem to become, in many cases, almost rote. We just do them automatically. And I'm wondering, what do the religious leaders or spiritual leaders have in mind in terms of translating those rituals into things that are more tangible that people can identify with in this day and age and in each culture that we live in? Given, especially in our country, in our culture, that we have such freedoms that we may take for granted, such comforts in life that may distract us from really feeling the message of liberation that these rituals and this time of year may be trying to convey.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Yes, and thanks for the question. We preachers and rabbis and imams always wrestled with how do you take the ancient story and make it alive and also enable the people to derive new energy for faithfulness from it. First of all, you must remember that these stories are not just preached on high holy days. They are a part of the continuing instruction of the faithful. And in instructional settings, the question is almost always raised, here's the story. Now, how does that touch your life? It is the educational process in the telling of the story over and over that allows people to access its deeper meaning. Secondly, in regards to the actual celebrations of the day, listen, we are always looking for fresh ways to get at this story. New music emerges. We have the ritual, new colors are employed. Poetry, contemporary poetry, brought in, so that we are working on it. And clearly, each one of us with responsibility for congregations, we are trying to find how do we say this year what Easter means or what Passover means or whatever the other celebrations are. How do we say it this year so that it intersects with the issues and the struggles that people are facing? For an example, no matter which religion it is, no leader will get away without in some way having to respond, how do our stories give light on what we have passed through in terms of war, conflict that between nations, conflict locally and nationally. The preacher's job is to provide what Tillich called the point of correlation. There is the eternal truth in the story, but that eternal truth has to be related to the concreteness of day-to-day existence, and that's what the system is about. And then, almost always, the religious leader says to people, it's sort of out there like a smorgasbord. And not everybody will see it the same way. Not everybody's taste is the same. But this story is big enough, foundational enough, that if you bring to it your ultimate concerns, you're likely to find something on this table that will address an area that needs nourishment in your life. All of these are ways in which that ancient story becomes contemporarized so that people can figure out, how do I live tomorrow in the light of the things we celebrate today?
And we should probably just mention that Paul Tillich, who you referred to a moment ago, is a prominent theologian. I want to go back to Richard, though, and just pose the question of whether this is a time that you normally observe and celebrate in some way, Richard, and whether you feel a particular need to do that this year.
Yes, it is. And I think the answer is yes, I do feel a particular need, but I also feel that at large, everyone should feel this particular need, but I'm not sure that everyone does, which was really the source of my question. How do religious or spiritual leaders break through the cloud, the fog? I mean, even in the aftermath of 9/11 and more recently, the conflict with Iraq and everything leading up to it, there seems to be still in this country, people don't get certain things regarding our own personal freedoms. And while I understand what your guest has said about education and retelling the stories from year to year, I still am looking for, through my own personal celebration and reenactment of rituals from year to year, a way to connect to what's going on today on a more global level. I'm not sure if I've articulated that very well.
No, I think you said it very well, Richard. We appreciate the call. What about that, Dr. Forbes? And also, I'm wondering, are there secular equivalents to these holy days? Certainly, we saw a need for people to observe the events of September 11th in the first year anniversary. I would imagine that's going to be something that we will be observing in this country for a very, very long time to come.
Yes, I believe that there are always secular expressions of the things that we do within faith traditions. And so every time a group of people look back on their foundation and seek to identify what were the principles that gave rise to, say, the founding of our nation, and if on 4th of July we celebrate the values that are resident in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, in the Bill of Rights, so as to rekindle our faithfulness to the values that we believe to be foundational to who we are. So it happens in the secular world. I agree that every year for a long time we will be commemorating the events of 9/11, attempting to find out what went on and how are we as an American people strong enough to withstand? And how do we respond in ways that in some way honor the nature of the founding of our nation? How do we preserve the freedoms that we are so frequently celebrate as a part of our heritage? We do it in secular ways, and we also do it in religious ways. And the gift of the religious is that the religious asks about ultimate reality. It asks about the foundations upon which reality itself and life itself has been built. And that's a very unique contribution that we make. And I hear Richard's frustration about, you know, it seems so difficult to get people activated about it. What we preach is that we put in our titles that we're going to sing. We raise provocative questions so as to give people the awareness that this year the service is not going to just be business as usual. It will take seriously the questions that people are asking. But I share the same frustration, Richard, how to get folks to be aware that maybe what's being said on these high holy days would provide for us the strength we need to face whatever the uncertain future is going to be.
Well, Dr. Forbes, I have a feeling, having never been there, but I do have the feeling just speaking with you today, it is not boring in your congregation at any time.
Well, we try to bring the imaginative, we try to bring our biblical insights, we try to bring the artistic reflections, and yes, we try to be in resonance with the pulsing life that we talk about as a result of the resurrection.
Let's go to another caller now in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sudhir is phoning in. Hello, Sudhir.
Hey, Gail. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome. Go ahead.
I come from India, and I wanted to take this conversation a little bit towards the subcontinent and the areas around the subcontinent. What we have been constantly viewing there is that these rituals and the days on which these rituals are conducted or observed are typically the days of violence. You know, there have been cases where Christians have been killed by Muslims, or Hindus have been tortured by Muslims, or Muslims have been tortured by Hindus and vice versa on their important days. So my question to the guest is, why follow these rituals? These rituals are supposed to be the days on which people stop and take a relook at what they're trying to do and achieve. But what is the stake? I mean, why do anything which costs lives? That's my question.
Sudhir, I think it's fair to say that's the eternal question, isn't it, Dr. Forbes?
It certainly is. And, you know, I think that history forces us to read our ancient stories anew and to find elements of truth that we may not have paid as much attention to before. For an example, the night before Jesus went to trial, they apprehended him in the Garden of Gethsemane, and one of the disciples took a sword and cut off the ear of the servant of the high priest. At that point, Jesus said to them, "No more of this." That is one of the most powerful expressions, because the crucifixion of Jesus is his way of saying violence must end. And in order for it to end, I make a sacrifice of my life. I will be struck by the priest or by the soldiers, and I will be accused falsely, and they will take my life. But I will not retaliate in kind, so as to say there comes a point when one would rather receive abuse and violence, but to stop it by refusing to perpetuate the cycle of such violence. This is not always spoken, even in Christian circles, but I think this year Muslims, Jews, and Christians will be listening very carefully to our stories to hear in the stories God's call beyond the myths of sacred violence to the pursuit of peace as a very serious element of our faith. We will not abandon the sense of self-defense, though in Jesus's case, his message was, rather even than to defend myself, I would rather receive this indignity to my persons, and to let it be a signal to all who will be my followers that peace is the way, that they who live by the sword will perish by the sword. So I hear that message, and I think what we're going to need in this country is religious leaders from the various faith traditions coming together and once again reading their own sacred texts and exegeting their sacred rituals to see, is there a word we have been overlooking that has led us to believe that when we are engaged in violence against one another, we are doing the will of God? Is there a demonstration that the will of God for us is that we learn to live together in peace? And then what resources does the faith offer to help us to live that way without simply being sitting ducks for the violence of everybody else? These are difficult questions, but we have to keep asking them. And this year, I think we're going to ask them more seriously than we have some years before.
Sudhir, do you share Dr. Forbes' optimism that perhaps people will hear these messages differently now?
Well, I do share the optimism, but the only thing that I am apprehensive about is the kind of time that it might take before these realizations dawn on people.
I think that's right. I share your concern as well. It is as if there is a virus in our system, and I mean by that the body politic and the individuals who are part of it, that we have had for a long time the development of a sense of revenge, resentment, uncertainty, insecurity, and we have been at least led to believe that by using methods of violence, we can some way protect ourselves against the insecurity, the vulnerability. But I am very much concerned that high holy...
Connection listeners, we are talking this hour about holy days with the Reverend James Forbes. And what about you? Are there rituals of remembrance that hold special meaning in your life? You can call us and become part of the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about freedom and remembrance and the rituals we turn to this time of year with Passover and Easter celebrations. My guest is the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr. of the Riverside Church in New York. And if you've been with us for most of the past hour, you can probably understand why his name turns up regularly on lists of the best preachers in America. Before the break, we asked what rituals of remembrance hold meaning for you. And also, I want to ask Dr. Forbes, picking up on Sudhir's point that we heard just before we went to the break, clearly there is some value to remembrance, as you've been telling us, but is there any point to it if there's not also some transformational carryover into our everyday existence?
Yes, the need to hear the story is great, but if the story does not lead to transformation of consciousness that then leads to transformed behavior, then we don't quite make the mark that we intended. I'm going to be trying to talk about when Easter happens to us. If Easter happens to us, we will rise in newness of life. The first thing happens is we can learn to live by grace. We will know that we are forgiven. And people who discover that they are forgiven are likely not to be as aggressive in reaching out in vengeance against other people. Another thing we learn is that our possibilities exceed what would appear to be our feasibilities. I think that's the way I need to say that. Easter should get folks moving to believe, oh, what I've always thought I could do, that I've given up on. I've buried these hopes and these dreams. Maybe I can resurrect these hopes and dreams and get started again. These notions about a change, I'm called upon to love people. If I'm really too defensive and very much insecure, maybe I can't love. But Easter suggests, Jim, you can be a person of integrity, and even though you may be attacked or either under constant criticism, you can still be a person of integrity, and God stands with you. I think that Easter and Passover ought to be times in which we say, let's try it again, because God is still with us amidst the struggles of life.
Let's go back to our phone calls. Bill has been standing by, phoning in from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hello, Bill.
Hi, yes. I wanted to ask how the symbolic meaning of these rituals does change over time. I mean, if you look back, 2,000 years ago, when some of these, the modern concept of freedom really was not developed yet, and I'm wondering how the modern concept of freedom has become part of what these very old rituals are now.
Well, freedom is freedom. Whatever binds us, we would wish to be liberated from that. I believe that there is the issue of life, and whatever you have as life, there are always threats to life as we know it. And freedom in any age is the capacity to press on to fulfill one's destiny in spite of the threats or the limitations or the confinements that we may encounter along the way. It takes different philosophic expressions, or there are different symbols about it, but at the end of the day, to be free involves having some sense of what I was meant to be, having some sense that the power of God is still with me in spite of the threats around me, and to experience something about releasing the song that's inside of us, fulfilling the project of life that we feel we have been given. It doesn't matter when and where that comes. It's a matter of hallelujah, thank God, when we are able to operationalize the dream that's in our heart, which we believe God placed there in the beginning.
Thanks so much for the call, Bill. Let's go to George now, who is on the line from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hello, George.
Hi, good morning to you and your guest. I like the idea of using the celebration of ritual as an occasion to pause from the hectic, rushed lives that we live. But I'm also wondering whether or not these celebrations may actually accelerate on some level that rush, as we rush to buy the Christmas presents or prepare for the Easter celebrations and so forth. Do these rituals become in some way just another extension of commercialism and our endless quest to buy and purchase and sell and fuel the economy?
Interesting reality check there,
yes,
because Dr.
Is.
Forbes, there is, holidays are a very, very busy time for people, even more so than usual.
Yes, and what we need to be aware of is that in terms of marketing, et cetera, a good marketer always looks at where is their meaning and where do we get a chance to exploit the meaning. So I understand that. My job is to say...
George, let's go back to you for a moment, because I want to ask, while we're getting Dr. Forbes back on the line, sometimes the technical gremlins jump into our conversations. George, I'm wondering whether you try on a conscious level not to be overwhelmed by the commercial demands of holidays, to really make an effort to focus on what they are supposed to be about.
Yes, I think one can do that on a very private level. The problem seems to be, though, when sort of the public demand and you're surrounded by it and inundated by it, and the holiday lights go up months before the season and so forth, and you see it as part of a huge, I think almost as Dr. Forbes was suggesting, a marketing reality. It becomes increasingly difficult to remind oneself, it seems to me, what the real purpose of the celebration happens to be. And I think one has to sort of make a pact with the people around oneself not to get sucked into the buying frenzy and sort of decide that, you know, instead of exchanging gifts, let's do something else. Let's contribute to some cause or what have you.
All right, George. Well, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. We also have another caller who has one example of a way to stay focused on what the holidays should be about. He's phoning in from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Don. What's the story you wanted to tell us?
Well, thank you for having me on. I thought it would be interesting for listeners to know about efforts at the grassroots that are attempting in an interfaith context to bring together Jews, Muslims, and Christians. We held a week ago at a church in Wellesley a Seder for the children of Abraham, Hagar, and Sarah. This was a Seder sponsored by the Friends of Open House, a group in support of a Jewish-Arab coexistence center in Israel. And our work here is an attempt to bring that spirit to communities here. We use the traditional structure of the Seder, but wove into it passages from the Quran and from the New Testament. And I think this was the first Seder, certainly for any of us in attendance, where we heard the Passover story in Hebrew and English in the traditional verses that we had been accustomed to. But we also heard in Arabic, chanted from the Quran, the story of the Exodus. And it was a remarkable experience for all of us, and both for really for members of each group. I think we moved and healed in a way that was very profound. We have a Haggadah that is in that we developed for this, the book one uses for the Seder, that we think can be an incredible tool to bring people together. And I was wondering if Dr. Forbes had some sense of the value of using traditions like this for interfaith work.
Yes, I believe that interfaith work will be one of the growing edges for the recovery of deep spirituality in our nation. I think that when we get together, first of all, we are required to know what our own individual traditions are about. And when we know that, so that we can share it with others, there is a richness that often comes as if it's fresh water from the wells of salvation. And so I suggest that the great awakening in America is going to be not just my tradition alone, but when I, out of the depths of my renewed faith, can talk with Muslims and Jews and religionists, Buddhists, Hindus, other religions, that there's a new energy. And I think God smiles on that as we try to move towards peace in this age of globalization.
Thanks so much for the call, Don. We appreciate hearing from you. And Dr. Forbes, I know you're off very shortly to a special service at your church. I'm curious to know how special a time this is for you. Is this perhaps even more than Christmas?
Easter is at the heart of our faith. We are happy at Christmas, but Easter reminds us that the Lord God who made the earth is still with us, and that the call to love and peace and justice, that's a good call. It has struggle. Some will suffer, some will die, but God is faithful, and that those who organize their lives around hope are likely to make the most significant contribution to the world as it grapples with its new problems. This is the energizing season. This is the season of renewal, the season of refreshment for our spirits. It's very, very special to me.
And is that the theme you're going to be striking this afternoon? Is that what we just heard, a little preview?
In a sense, I will be talking today about strength for the struggle. Because Jesus, the night when he was just beginning into this end time for him, was praying hard, "Not my will, but thine be done. Father," he said, "let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but thine be done." And in that setting, the text says, and an angel was sent from heaven to strengthen him. And what I'm going to be talking about is, yes, life is filled with many struggles. We're going to have some hard days ahead. We're going to experience some diminishment of the resources we may have used for things we thought valuable. But don't give up, because the God who calls us to integrity, justice, love, and peace will also send us the strength to go through the struggle and come out with a victorious sense that having been faithful was worth the ride.
Dr. Forbes, does it bother you at all that the name Easter actually comes from a pagan festival, that in the second century there were Christian missionaries who were converting pagans and basically incorporated some of these holidays and some of the spring celebrations into the message that they were trying to bring?
Well, you know, I, as a Christian, believe that the whole enterprise of human existence is a God-oriented thing. And from a God's eye point of view, as I try to imagine that, it's true that we borrow from each other symbols and expressions. And the Lord God does not get upset when I can find something that comes from another tradition that helps me be faithful to my own. And for that reason, then, hey, I don't worry too much where it all came from. I'm worried about, can we gather it and offer it back to God in a way that honors the love to which we are called? And that's my attitude. I'll be borrowing a lot, and I hope others will borrow from my Christian tradition. And at the end of the day, God delights and say, at least my children are sharing with each other now.
So you have no problem with the Easter Bunny?
I do have a problem with the Easter Bunny. You know what? I just hope that what we do in our services of worship are powerful enough that they compete against lesser meanings. That's what I talked about, the fact that people get shortchanged if they simply go through these little cheery activities that do not get to the heart of what life is all about. Don't shortchange yourself with Easter eggs and bunnies and shopping. We are talking about something that equips one for life, for struggling through with a sense of confidence and hope. Don't go for the cheap thing. We've got the real thing. Of course, we can say that, but what people find when they come to our houses of worship has got to be real. It's got to have a dynamic. It's got to have some energy, and it's got to have some hope. Perhaps we at least should be as good marketers of real faith as others are of some other approaches to life.
Well, Dr. Forbes, I know what a busy season this is for you. We thank you so much for joining us today.
I've enjoyed the conversation, and happy Easter, happy Passover to everybody this year.
Thank you. The Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr. is Senior Minister of the Riverside Church in New York. We offer special thanks today as well to John Dingus and Dave Coffin for use of the Columbia University Journalism School studio. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Mark Allard is with Dick Gordon in Baghdad. Our interns are Danya Akkad, Andrea Liebman, and Lisa Rufino. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.